Welcome to the Development Policy Center. The US and China have followed parallel paths as providers of foreign aid over the past seven decades. Both have used aid in different ways, but to further their own strategic influence. In this podcast, Patrick Kilby discusses his new book on the subject and argues that the US should carefully consider conceding the aid race to China. Professor Frank Bongiorno introduces the lecture and Stephen Howes chairs. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming along to our event today. My name's Stephen Howes and I direct the Development Policy Centre. And to begin, let us acknowledge the First Australians, the traditional owners of the land on which we're meeting. And let us pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, past and present. So the rest of the university might be winding down, but we still have a whole lot of events to go before the end of the year. And I think we've got about four or five. So it's still a busy time for us, and this is the first of our end-of-the-year events. I just want to mention one more, which is on Monday. So Patrick's a star, but on Monday we have a superstar, who's Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who is now the chair of GAVI, the Global Vaccination Alliance, but who was the finance minister of Nigeria twice and managing director of the World Bank. So it's very rarely we get a sort of African leader, let alone an African superstar, to come and give a lecture. And we have this annual Mitchell Oration, and she's giving it this year. And she's talking on development towards 21st century approaches. So I'm taking it because you're all here, you're probably interested in development. So I really encourage you to come along on Monday. It's in the same building in our big Molonglo Lecture Theatre at 5:30. And it is followed by drinks, another reason to come. Anyway, so there's that and a number of other events. Have a look at on the table as you go out. But today we are going to launch and discuss a book or a monograph that our colleague Dr. Patrick Kilby has just written. So for those of you who don't know him, and I'm sure a lot of you do, come in. Patrick's over in the College of Arts and Social Sciences, I think in the Anthropology School, but he's actually a political scientist. And I think the notable thing about Patrick, what I'd highlight is his interest in a range of different areas to do with aid. Of course, he's a real scholar of the NGO sector, and he recently wrote the history of ACFID, the Australian Council for International Development, the peak body for development NGOs. But he also has this interest in the geopolitics of aid and foreign policy links, and it's that's led him to write this monograph on China and the United States as aid donors' past and future trajectories. So we benefit from Patrick's expertise and interest in a number of areas. So before Patrick comes and talks about his book, and after that there will be opportunity for a Q&A, to begin with I'm going to ask my colleague Professor Frank Bongiorno, who's a professor of history here at the ANU, and also a well-known TV personality, to come and launch the monograph, say a few words. And it's great, Frank, to have you here. Have someone, you know, with broader interest come and talk to us in on this issue of development and geopolitics. So please welcome Professor Frank Bongiorno.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks also to Patrick for inviting me to launch his book today. It's become a cliche, of course, to assert that the rise of China is the most significant international phenomenon of our times, that rivalry between a declining power, the United States, and a rising one, the People's Republic of China, poses one of the most serious threats to global stability and peace. We hear frequently of the Thucydides trap, which we're warned might lead us to a war that no one wants, but none can avoid. You know, Athens and Sparta, America and China. Here's how our colleague Hugh White, one of the most prolific and astute commentators on these matters and their implications for Australia, opens his new quarterly essay, Without America, Australia in the New Asia, just released. He says, for almost a decade now, the world's two most powerful countries have been competing over which of them will dominate the world's most important and dynamic region. America has been trying to remain East Asia's primary power, and China has been trying to replace it. Their contest is playing out over trade deals and infrastructure plans, in the diplomacy of multilateral meetings, and above all, through military gamesmanship in regional hotspots like the South China Sea, the East China Sea, and the Korean Peninsula. But all these are really just symptoms of their underlying rivalry. And while he doesn't mention it directly here, Hugh could, I think, just as easily have included aid among the issues over which US-China rivalry is playing out. So we're fortunate to have such an informative account of the respective roles of the United States and China as aid donors from Patrick Kilby, in his new book, China and the United States as Aid Donors, Past and Future Trajectories. The title might not be the sexiest, but the subject is a pressing one for anybody who worries that the present US-Chinese rivalry might yet conform to the patterns of the 1910s or the 1930s, or even perhaps 5th century Greece. But perhaps one of the most worrying of Patrick's findings is that he reveals, I think, American indifference and disengagement in relation to China's vastly expanded aid efforts of recent years, rather than perhaps the direct rivalry that might at least indicate an understanding on America's part of what's at stake. Patrick reveals two quite different and even separate histories in dealing with the United States and China, two contrasting understandings of what aid should look like and what it should do. These differences, moreover, are playing out in quite significant ways now that China has moved decisively towards using aid as an instrument of soft power. Now, I first became aware of Patrick's work when, as a member of the Social Sciences Board of ANU Press, we endorsed for publication his fine history of the Australian Council for International Development. Although ostensibly and explicitly an institutional history, the history of an organisation, Patrick's book was in essence a history of the role of Australian NGOs in providing overseas aid since the 1960s, and it's quickly taken its place as a very highly regarded work on its subject. I was then, a few years later, working in the archive of the World Bank in Washington, and I couldn't help but notice that a significant number of the files that I was ordering still had a sticker on them, announcing that a certain researcher, a Dr. Patrick Kilby of the Australian National University, had been at them before me. So much for original research. Don't tell the ARC. It was clear that Patrick was a thorough and well-travelled scholar, as well as a shrewd commentator on Australian aid policy. Now, the story that Patrick tells in this book is important as history, as well as being a guide to unravelling the puzzles of a very challenging present. China, of course, has under Xi Jinping been, and I'm quoting from Patrick here, ramping up its own foreign aid and investment programs via such well-known programs as the Belt Road Initiative and the Silk Road Fund, designed, as Patrick says, to expand both overland and maritime trade links of China with Europe, Central, South Asia and Africa. There's also, of course, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, established partly to challenge the World Bank. One estimate of Chinese global aid for 2012, and that's, of course, a few years ago now, had it at $12.8 billion, making China, once adjustments are made for per capita income, one of the world's most generous aid donors. Patrick also argues that the Chinese have tended to apply a relatively light touch in terms of recipient obligations. Support for the One China policy was perhaps the most significant condition and one pursued with renewed vigour in recent years. Now, for the Chinese, aid is about displaying leadership and prestige, a part of China, as Patrick puts it, establishing itself in the world. But Patrick shows that the Chinese didn't stumble into aid, that China became increasingly involved in aid as an expression of South-South solidarity in the years that followed the Bandung Conference of 1955. China became more involved in aid to Africa, particularly, and also to Asia, as an aspect of its rivalry with the Soviet Union after the Sino-Soviet split, the PRC using aid as a way of drawing developing countries out of the Soviet orbit and into a Chinese one. The climax of this effort was the Tazara Railway, which connected the Zambian copper mines to Tanzanian ports, allowing Tanzania to bypass white minority Rhodesia and South Africa. The 2,000-kilometre line, whose construction began in 1970, was completed ahead of schedule in 1975 with, The numbers are really quite bewildering. 14,000 Chinese and 38,000 African workers. And in some ways, as Patrick suggests, foreshadowing the very energetic railway construction that's been a part of Chinese investment and indeed aid in recent years. China increased its aid effort in the 1970s with two-thirds of its expenditure for the whole of the period from the 1950s to the 70s being between 1970 and 1977 alone. And by 1977, the latter of those dates, there were more than 70 recipient countries. So it's also growing in breadth as well as in depth. It should be recalled that this growing Chinese effort coincided with those years when OPEC was awash with cash in the wake of the oil price hikes. Its members accounted for a third of all foreign aid in 1978. So in other words, as Patrick points out, for a few years, South-South aid cooperation appeared, and I'm quoting here from him, a viable alternative to the West and the Soviet Union. Now, there were good reasons why developing countries might look to China in this period, quite beside China's relatively undemanding nature as a donor nation. For the United States, dependent to a great extent on the doubtful and inconstant largesse of Congress, the US tended to turn the tap on and off, and it viewed aid in the context of its self-proclaimed manifest destinies. And that could be onerous, of course, for those on the receiving end of aid. The United States' modern effort, says Patrick, had its origins in the Truman era and the early politics of the Cold War, and especially the threat posed by the Soviet Union to Greece and Turkey around 1947. Under Eisenhower in the 1950s, there was less emphasis on aid and more on military spending. But the Kennedy era is rightly recalled as having seen a renewed push for international aid. This was, of course, the era of the Peace Corps and of Walt Rostow's The Stages of Economic Growth, a non-communist manifesto, very pointed title, connecting, of course, American idealism, capitalist expansion and anti-communism as bedfellows, as they'd been in the late 40s. And, of course, Rostow was a significant figure in both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. But aid was cut under Johnson, Kennedy's successor, and as post-war capitalism's golden era turned into the turbulent 70s and then the globalising 1980s, US-led Western aid was increasingly set within a neoliberal or free market agenda. There were further cuts to aid under Clinton before the 2000s and the George W. Bush presidency saw aid budgets increase and designed to counter terrorism and bolster what were called fragile states. US aid budgets increased, but they never approached the early 1960s levels as a proportion of budget outlays. 0.85% in 2016 was up from 0.55% in 2002, but some way from the extraordinary, really, 3% of 1962. Trump, of course, wants to cut aid drastically, although Patrick says meeting resistance, and I presume we'll hear more about that in a moment. And, you know, in some ways that has been a very eloquent expression, if eloquent is ever the right word to use in relation to Trump, but I'll call it an eloquent expression of the United States' abrogation of global leadership, as might be found anywhere in its increasingly disastrous domestic politics. Now, while a policy of this kind might be lamentable in any circumstances, it's particularly so in a climate where China is so effectively increasing its global presence and prestige through aid. Patrick suggests that there are reasons to be concerned about the United States' lack of engagement. There is, of course, no reason to mourn the decline of aid in the service of a faltering neoliberal agenda. Nevertheless, the Chinese version of aid, in its emphasis on the strong state and the rejection of Western efforts to promote good governance, will not advance liberal values or democratic freedoms. That's not what it's intended to do, quite the reverse. Rather, as in every other field of international policy, China will demand the right to help shape norms and rules. And the results of this are unlikely to be palatable in every case in the views, or tastes, I should say, of Westerners. To the extent that the United States retreats from its global role, it will struggle to imprint the best of its own values through international aid. Australia, too, will likely find itself increasingly pursuing goals fruitlessly in a vacuum created by the retreat of US power internationally and regionally. Australia will find itself increasingly in more direct competition with China in places such as Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and will be in no position to dictate the rules of engagement, or possibly even apply the most basic of its own criteria to its programs. The new Australian Foreign Policy White Paper talks, and it only deals with aid pretty briefly in a breakout box, but it talks of using aid, and I quote, to strengthen the private sector and supporting human development. It announces a focus on, see if you can guess what the next word might be, a focus on innovation, and seeks to encourage private sector-led growth and job creation. Now, with the eclipse of the US in what that document, the White Paper, likes to call the Indo-Pacific, however, the rules of the game might end up well and truly out of Australia's hands, as well as, of course, out of the hands of the United States. So, to conclude, we're indebted to Patrick, as well as to his publisher, the Honolulu-based East-West Centre, for the expertise in international aid he brings to this study, and for the clarity with which he sets out the history and dilemmas posed by these really massive changes in the balance of global and regional power. And my most important duty, of course, is to wave the book around. I was very worried that it mightn't be here. It is here, so I can wave it. And I have much pleasure in declaring launched China and the United States as aid donors, past and future trajectories. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. And as usual, acknowledgements. I've got to thank Stephen and the Dev Policy Institute for arranging the launch. Satu Limay and the East West Centre in their Washington office for hosting me for 3 months earlier this year. And the East West Centre is in the firing line. And the Trump budget, zero for the East West Centre. And I'll come back to it, but I suspect it will survive. And Dieter and Marcus are the editors, and Dieter's actually here at the ANU, Elisa Johnson for making it happen for the launch. And so not only do I have a physical copy, but it's actually live online as of yesterday. Okay, and they will feature it for a week or two as in their rotating front page. So, and also to Frank for such an eloquent launch. And Frank's actually covered some of the major themes of it, so I'm not going to sort of repeat that, which is good, simply because I want to pick out a couple of particular things. But I've also got to thank my partner, Joyce Wu, who is here as well, for her forbearance for my being away for 3 months, as well as her invaluable support that she provides me for all of my endeavours, which tend to go in all sorts of directions. And this is actually very serendipitous. And so this was organised some time ago, but as Frank mentioned, we have the launch of the Foreign Policy White Paper last week, and next week from Hugh White we have the launch of his quarterly essay. And in a sense, the White Paper takes a don't mention the war sort of approach, while Hugh takes the exact opposite approach, which is, oh, we're doom and gloom. And Tony Walker in the Sydney Morning Herald says it reads like a Tom Clancy novel. I wish. I don't think mine reads like a Tom Clancy novel. but this paper, while ostensibly being about aid, about US aid, but it's also very relevant to Australia with essentially the same messages, and Frank touched on that. The other issue is that events change quickly. And so things like this can fall out of date sort of very quickly. And so I had a bit of a debate because the first sentence is, the Trump administration's 2018 budget proposes to cut US foreign aid by one third. Okay, and I didn't have that there, but Dieter and Marcus said, no, you need a hook. Just say it. I says, but it probably won't happen. This doesn't matter. That is the administration's policy. So there it is. According to my search on the Congress website this morning, aid may actually increase. the Senate wants an increase. The House hasn't quite got back, but the House wants a cut of about 10%. not 30%. And the Senate wants a cut of about 5%. Now it looks like an increase. So, but the interesting thing is this is the first, I think it's probably the first time in the US where the Senate hasn't advocated a cut over the president's desire to either maintain or increase aid. Here, the president wants to decrease it by a third, and the Senate says no way. And I think the reason is they've been lobbied quite a bit by the US military and others to say we cannot cede the patch to China, which is the message that Frank mentioned as well. So it is about really holding an engagement. And the other question, which is a source of endless, there's even websites devoted to it, and it's a sort of subset of development studies, is how much aid does China give? Very hard to work out, simply because the Development Assistance Committee sort of, it calculates this and only calculates what they know, and it comes up with it, and according to its rule, it comes up with it quite a low figure. And then China, the Standing Committee, which is quite a big group of politicians in China, it doesn't want to know how much aid China gives either, to avoid the Jackie Lambie, Pauline Hanson types in the Standing Committee objecting to it. So China tends to not talk too much about volumes, and tends to, when it does through its white paper, tends to really strict, you know, to particular things such as the DAC does. But also China doesn't count a whole lot of stuff, simply because it's not accounted for in a different way, not because it's kept secret, like the number of students doesn't get counted. In Australia, everywhere else, they get counted. The nature of technical assistance, how is that counted? How is it valued? And in the 70s, the DAC did a look at China's aid, and they says, well, it doesn't pay at the big fat consultancy rates that West does. It pays at a much lower rate, so its value is much, much greater. So, you know, the guesstimate at about 14, 15 billion is probably closer to the mark but at the end of the day, it's a guess because the Chinese government, for its own internal political reasons, doesn't want to inflate the level of aid it gives, unlike governments in Australia and other places where they start adding things in. China likes to sort of keep stuff out. So, but there's a couple of key points in this paper. One is there's two quite different aid philosophies. And the first is raised by Zhou Enlai in particular. Now, the book has Mao's picture on the cover. My book carefully avoids, I think Mao is mentioned once, partly because there's some scholars sort of talk about Mao and Zhou being on the same page, and people have done, you know, looked at archives and find, oh, they are on the same page. Well, the archives would say that, wouldn't they? But as far as I could make out, Zhou and Lai had quite different messages in his diplomatic approaches. And the fact that he was really treated very shabbily when he was very ill and when he died, you know, is another indication that they may not have been, you know, on the same page. Well, Mao was very much into exporting revolution and did so quite aggressively through Southeast Asia in particular, with Cambodia being probably the most egregious example. While Zhou Enlai tended to work the African space, and somebody pointed out that China only sort of tried to export revolution to three countries in Africa, and in each case it came third each time, Namibia, Mozambique and South Africa. So Zhou Enlai was very much on about this notion of South-South, Southern solidarity. And he referred to the century of humiliation. And that keeps mentioned, a Chinese colleague who listened to about an hour of Xi Jinping's three-hour speech to the Congress said he opened up with this references to the century of humiliation. And that is a driving narrative. And that's why I focus on Zhou, what Zhou was saying. And the century of humiliation was from the Opium Wars through to the Communist Revolution. But you could add another 10 years because the split with the Soviet Union was very much about the overbearing, humiliating attitude that the Soviet Union was taking at the time. But it is a constant refrain, and it's been reiterated. It's taught in schools, you know. Chinese students say, oh, no, we get it all the time, you know. So it is a central part of that narrative. So it's about China's place in the world, and now Xi Jinping is sort of really emphasising it about make China great again, and a whole lot of stuff about, you know, the glory days. Of course, history of China is a very much up and down. It wasn't sort of, you know, single, you know, century of glory or something. But nevertheless, it's a central part of that narrative. The other thing is Zhao Enlai has these 5 points of mutual cooperation, which are getting a bit of airplay now, and they're reiterated. But 10 years later, that was 55, 10 years, well, 54 and 55, it was discussed with the treaty with India where Nehru and Zhao developed them, but it was reiterated at Bandung as a central guiding principle for southern South-South cooperation. But 10 years later, in 64, during a trip to Africa, he announced his 8 principles of development cooperation. And I won't go through them. And again, you can look at the world. China doesn't do that, China, but it sort of does. You know, there's always exceptions to these rules. But the first one is absolutely fascinating, and there's various translations of it. A lot of translations don't have it. But in Zhao's archive, which, you know, the Brookings Institute has a digital archive of Zhao stuff, he refers to they give aid for mutual support, not as universal almsgiving, not as charity. And the notion of charity versus gift-giving is important. You know, charity has a power relationship associated about it. While gift-giving, you give people presents. Yeah, and you don't expect a present back, but it's nice when it happens. But if you keep giving gifts and you get no acknowledgement, then you stop giving the gift. But it's very much a softer touch, that gift-giving thing. There is mutuality expected, and, of course, how that pans out depends quite a bit. And I did say in the book, on the back cover, it sort of says aid race to its apolitical competitor. And now, a draft of the cover for my approval came through a couple of weeks ago, and it had apolitical without inverted commas. And I says, oh, my God, I'm going to look so naive if that stands there. So I had, can you put that, please put that in inverted commas, simply because... Xi Jinping, as I said, the narrative keeps changing events, but Xi Jinping is really starting to push a philosophical agenda as well, okay, which is relatively recent, you know, and he does talk about, a Confucian model. And last week I was in Singapore at a conference with Yangyang University, and someone is talking about South-South cooperation between Singapore and China, where they train lots and lots and lots of Chinese public servants. And the comment was, there's a belief that China is following the Singapore model. And I thought, well, that's a bit of a stretch. But I have absolutely no doubt that Lee Kuan Yew, because he's a member of the Malay Communist Party in the 50s, would certainly have interacted with Zhou Enlai, for sure. And he would have interacted with Deng Xiaoping in the 80s as well. So I think the Singapore model being followed by China, I think there's a bit more mutuality happening there, and I don't think China would sort of say it's following the Singapore model. But there is a lot of similarity about a Confucian approach, which is, you know, fairly hierarchical, fairly patriarchal. It's a whole lot of things there. And that's a philosophy which Xi Jinping is starting to mention more and more, which is a little bit different from Zhou Enlai, which is about solidarity. Deng Xiaoping introduced the economics to it, and he actually, I mentioned this in the book, he didn't like giving aid. He really thought, you know, we've got to get something back for this. And so it really flattened out over over the 80s until the Tiananmen Square incident, which really, the backlash by the West on China over Tiananmen Square, a lot of loss of face, humiliated by it, and the only people who supported China then was Africa, and that was a big boost in aid to Africa. And now we have the, what's it called? The Forum on Chinese Aid to Africa, something like that, which meets every 2 years, which is another part of China's aid, which is it's a bit more multilateral in its approach. There's a lot more discussions among its partners as a group. And that Forum on China's Aid to Africa continues now. And I think that's very important. The other thing philosophically, besides Confucianism, is that there's a very much, I'd call it a Keynesian approach. I'm a big fan of Keynes, so that's why I call it a Keynesian approach, which is an a role of the state in regulating, in planning, and gap filling. The other thing is, Stephen may like to ponder an invitation to Justin Lin Fu, who was a former chief economist of the World Bank, and he's articulated this notion of new structural economics, which guides a lot of that infrastructure investment. It's about filling infrastructure gaps in societies.
He has spoken.
Invite him back. but that's their sort of philosophic approach. Well, the US goes back to the Monroe document. You know, its role in the world. U.S. exceptionalism, which I mentioned, probably goes back to the Mayflower and that sort of stuff. The notion of individualism. Thomas Jefferson, sent an expeditionary force to deal with slavers. But the notion was also to bring, the free market or whatever the expression was at the time, and American individualism, to West Africa. So that narrative has continued quite a bit, and there's a very strong anti-statist approach. What Harry Truman and Eisenhower afterwards, they always talked about, diminishing the role of the state. The massive investment in or investment to Europe after the war. The whole, I've got the mental block, but is what was not only about containing communism and having Europe actually trade with each other and cooperate with each other without fighting each other, and it was also a pump prime to both the US and what, but it's also to reduce the role of the state. And that's where it didn't work. Basically, I took the money, but Europe tended to keep quite a strong statist approach, which has irritated the US ever since. So the implications, and so that strong anti-statist approach is still continues. Trump made some comment about it a couple of months ago about anti-statism. And the strong state is very much central to China's approach. So the implications of non-engagement. And the engagement, the white paper the Australian white paper, I found the tone wasn't particularly helpful, but how it saw an engagement was as a competitor, not as an interlocutor. Let's have a conversation about some of this stuff. And aid doesn't enter that space, but where China is putting aid and investment and all sorts of other things into that space, then engaging is very important. Because the rising authoritarianism is an issue. I don't think China's particularly promoting authoritarianism. It doesn't care. But it wants safe and secure borders. And so it will probably prefer an authoritarian state than a fairly unstable democratic one on its borders. And I think that's an important one. But the engagement must go beyond trade. And again, last week, the Australian government, defence and foreign affairs sort of saw the Belt Road Initiative as a threat, while trade saw it as an opportunity. Hopefully we can all see it as an opportunity. It depends how the conversation occurs, simply because it's not going to stop. And what's happening, say, in Pakistan, which Joyce has been to, about the China the Pakistan China corridor, we really need to have conversations about, okay, how can we ameliorate the adverse effects of that? The fact that Cambodia is going very much, it's always been fairly authoritarian, but I think it feels more secure having China as a broker. But there's a big danger of falling into vassal state status. And Burma tried to come out of the cold because it was turning into a vassal state of China, and now it's sort of gone back into the cold because of a whole lot of other things. But it does create whole problems about that aid competition. So I think aid is a central part of the mix, and a dialogue has to occur, not about you should do this or you shouldn't do that, but rather how can we do stuff together. Oh, my next gig will be looking at the Green Revolution. I'm talking to people. Do you do anything with China about agricultural research in developing countries? No. I said, but China's got new varieties of rice for Africa, you know. Isn't that interesting? But it's not happening to the extent it should. And so that rivalry, or how do we have a conversation either with China or our foreign aid partners about what is happening in their country and how can we complement and improve the dialogue? So we basically, in my view, need to move beyond the dialogue of the deaf. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Patrick. So, yeah, perhaps not a dialogue of the deaf today. I don't need to really go up to 8 minutes. Take questions, Patrick, as they come.
You characterise the American position as anti-status. But in positive terms, how do they understand their approach? Like, is it ideological? Or?
The ideology would be the minimum role of the state in the affairs of society. So you privatise, quite a lot. You deregulate. The standard sort of that the neoliberal. And it's to promote the free market. State-owned enterprises shouldn't be part of the mix. There's all that sort of stuff. So the anti-statism is about the role of the state in their own societies, while China and most centrally planned economies, the state is central to that. But China's actually turning into a bit of a melange itself, because there's a whole lot of mix of how things happen. I mean, China's government is forever playing policy catch-up. Peter Harcher in the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday called China possibly a shadow democracy, because they're forever doing public opinion polls to see what people think, so they can sort of have policy catch-up so people don't get too upset. So I think that's part of it. Yep.
The aid by the US and the West is sometimes characterised as conditional aid, and that's in contrast to how the aid by China is characterised. Where do you sit on that?
And China's aid has more than just one condition, which is the One China policy. It actually has a lot of subtle conditions, as people have read, you know. If you get sucked into China's aid, this is where you turn into a vassal state, then your choices to do all sorts of things just get narrower, because you have particular donors, particular views. So the conditionality is a more subtle conditionality. China does like to employ its people, so it ties its aid, and I'm not against tied aid, but because it's partly to do with, you know, the Belt Road Initiative is like a China Marshall Plan. We do pump prime the China economy by exporting our labour and our investment in industrial capacity elsewhere. So you have that sort of thing. The West's conditionality is very much about what government should look like. You know, and there's big debates about what good governance what is in the mix or not in the mix, and that's always moving, and different countries see what constitutes good governance a little bit differently to others. Democracy was in the mix in the US, but only really after the end of the Cold War. I mean, the US, I think it was Johnson sort of said, you know, we may give aid to dictators, but they're our dictators. And they certainly didn't like giving aid to left-wing democracies, Chile being the most egregious example. But India, they really didn't like India, which was a thriving democracy. So there's a whole lot of... The conditions gets quite rubbery, but it's around what government should, or how government should govern. And some of that's to do with small government, but some of it's to do with smart government.
It's just my sense listening to you is that do you think that there's a well thought out strategy that's in play here, or do you think this is
in China or out?
From China.
From China.
Or do you think that this is just happening organically? And the other part of the question is the relationship between what you're calling aid and other major financial initiatives associated with that.
Yeah. There's always an element of ad hocracy, and scholars have written, you actually have to tease out what Chinese companies get up to, whether state-owned or privately owned in other countries, which sometimes get a very bad reputation, and what the state in its aid program or more structured investment programs get up to. And they're two different things, and they're often hard to unpack. Xi Jinping seems to have created this, I always call it the talisman, called the Belt Road Initiative, and you just fit everything into it. You know, I mean, anything pops up, oh, it's part of the Belt Road Initiative. This has nothing to do with, you know. So that becomes a framework, but China's so big and there's so many players, it's herding cats to some extent. But I went to a presentation by an archaeologist talking about the Belt Road Initiative. And part of it is this whole cultural thing going all the way. And they're restoring monuments, they're restoring whole lots of archives, you know, history. So they really are tying it down to the Silk Road of yore. So they are, has a whole cultural dimension to it as well. And then the mix between, you know, where something, where it's aid and where it's not aid, there's a whole grey patch in the middle, which, you know, there's whole teams of people try to unpack. From my archive work with the World Bank, which Frank alluded to, one of the things was what irritated China an awful lot, and which probably was a reason they weren't very good friends, they weren't flash on Africa in the 80s, was China went to the World Bank, said, good, we're signed up, you know, where's the deal? And they said, oh, we don't have enough money for you. You know, Africa's got first dibs on it. And looking at World Bank archives, that was a major source of irritation. But then the World Bank started doing blended loans, 30-60, 30% IDA, 60%, 70, whatever, 60-40, you know, the IFC, which is the general World Bank loan on less subsidised rates. So you end up with that. So China uses a lot of that blending, so where's the subsidy and where's the grant? But they also do a lot of traditional aid, like building schools and agricultural research, all that sort of stuff. Depending on the road, depends on whether it's likely to be, you know, be able to pay for itself or not. It's a very murky area, but the Belt Road Initiative, they're talking $1 trillion. A trillion is one of those numbers I have trouble conceptualising. But certainly, you know, a goodly bit of it, you know, would fit under an aid sort of definition. Yep, Susan.
Yes, very interesting. Thanks. I noticed most of the questions have been on the China side. could you perhaps explain or compare between the two aid programs, China and the US, perhaps the criteria that he used in terms of economic assessment, environmental, social assessment? Do you see big differences in the way that these are done, that projects roll out?
if I'd be sort of terribly politically incorrect, there may be a big difference in rhetoric. China, but China again is changing very quickly. The fact that it's having its own complete pollution crisis, you know, and it's moving so fast in cleaning stuff up, you know, and that's why every time you buy a solar panel, it comes from China. Electric car in a few years' time will come from China, basically because it has to deal with that. It'll be starting to exploit those technologies. It'll be starting to have much more environmental assessments, etc. But it takes the view that that sort of stuff is probably interfering. And so that's part of the conversation, I think, that we in Australia and other places can sort of say, well, hang on, you know, what about environmental issues? What about gender issues? You know, how is it disadvantaging this group versus that group? That conversation can happen. With the US, where places are important, I think those things matter less. Where they're less important, they start applying those things much more. Yep.
Sorry,
follow up.
I think significant that AIB has adopted a sort of international standard on governance.
Yeah, it's taken a lot of staff from the World Bank and a lot of policies from the World Bank. And I think that's part of that story. And that will have an effect.
Do you think it's possible that there may be some spin-offs in the aid program and things like the policy
banks? Yeah, I think that the Silk Road Fund, there's all these separate funds, and trying to get your head around them is also quite complicated, because the AIIB, it spends a lot of money in the Belt Road Initiative, as well as a Silk Road Fund, and there will have to be a policy, shift over among them. It's very hard for them to be all operating out of the same space, and not start to adopt similar policies. And also, if they want more credibility with the West, which is an important part of it, even though Xi Jinping wants China great again, but they do want that credibility. And so that's why they certainly don't like Western rules, but they've emphasised the UN rules quite a bit. And I think that's an important distinction they're very careful to make. And so the, the G77 plus China? Was it G77 never had China, and then in the early 2000s they sort of added China in, sort of. But its statements is very much anchored on UN rules and statements. So that's where, I'm sure there's hope in there. Yep. Faisal?
Yeah. What about the defence side of stuff? I mean, is China, for example, with Pakistan, is cooperating on quite a few things. They're developing a plane or something, and, you know, into tanks and shipbuilding and all that. So is China doing that encroachment as well on Africa and the rest of the world?
It depends on with whom. I also notice the US is negotiating arms sales to Pakistan as well. So Pakistan's very good at sort of playing various sides of the fence. It really depends on the country, etc. You know what's important. I suspect in the stands in Central Asia there would be a lot of security work there as well, because it's important for China to have these railway lines functioning every day, you know, all the time. And so there would be a lot of, I suspect there'd be security things in those places for more on the internal stability and anti-terrorist work and all that sort of stuff. Yep.
Thanks, and getting your perspective on this loss of the sort of political consensus around the value of aid. Seems that the timing of that's quite strange, given China's rise and the white paper sort of is strong on the challenges posed by that, but then just doesn't really follow through on what that means. And is there a failure in how we've presented, I guess, the value of aid?
If I go back a while. The Jackson Committee talked about the triple mandate, humanitarian, foreign policy, or, you know, strategic interests, and commercial interests. Now, China's aid exactly follows that triple mandate. And then various reviews ever since have shied away from that explicit, whether aid should be used for commercial purposes. Not as a subsidy, but a lot of our aid is actually to foster trade links with various countries, do port development, do all sorts of things, biosecurity funding, all that sort of stuff, which are about fostering greater trade capacity, which hopefully we will be a beneficiary of that. But the strategic, I notice the strategic importance of aid seems to have really fallen away. And I do think there has to be a better public conversation about that. Not as a way of, you know, tying it with the arms thing, which the Brits used to do in the 50s and that sort of stuff. Not that Cold War tying, which was very strong, but more about how do we engage with our partners, knowing that their biggest donor runs on a different system. And, you know, and we're not saying they shouldn't accept that, but have a conversation about, to what extent are you doing things you're not comfortable with? Some countries push back well and some don't. So it's not this, everything's going to be built China's way with China stuff and all that sort of stuff. In Angola, they had a two-phase thing on their oil for aid sort of thing. The first one, China did sort of was allowed to have open. So the second one, Angola said, no, you have to employ a proportion of Angolans and you have to follow our development plan, as in schools, health, what have you. Vanuatu cyclone. I was just talking to somebody who was very instrumental with the government there. He said basically China came in after the immediate emergency and just talked to the Prime Minister. What do you want? He said, I'll give you a shopping list. And they said, yes, but you have to employ Ni Vanuatu. So meet our list, schools, all that sort of stuff, and employ our people. So the pushback occurs, and so I think it varies. Some countries are not good at pushing back, but I think China needs those countries more than they need it. And I think, you know, getting people's heads around that is an important part of, as I say, becoming a vassal state where, you know, which can only end badly.
Patrick, I'll ask a question if I can. Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, I feel countries like Australia and the US, it is a difficult.
Yeah.
It's a difficult job. Like, you take Australia as a proxy for the US and take PNG, because we all know it.
Yeah.
So take PNG elections. Like, China couldn't care less about PNG elections, right? But we could. So A, we're going to help them.
Yeah.
And then B, we're going to kind of be unhappy when they don't go well, right? And then
yeah.
Diplomatic tension. So how, you know, what advice do you have for the US or Australia on how they should weigh, you know, one goal, which is just for PNG to like us rather than China, right?
I should be able to like both of us.
Well, as well as. Yeah. We say in the white paper we want PNG to look at Australia as a primary security partner. So on the one hand, should that be our goal, the goal of popularity versus upholding the things we believe in, like the importance of democracy?
This is why I'm not a politician. Because they're the balancing act. But it strikes me is China wants stable countries. Now, PNG is nowhere near its border, but who it interacts with. PNG is quite tricky for China because if it's too many Chinese staff going there, then there's riots. You know, the PNG does not like, you know, every, and this goes back to trade stores and history and all sorts of stuff. They see the Chinese, quite, and so China has to be quite careful about that. So I don't think it can do the complete takeover type thing. It would prefer a strong state. And so whether it would like the PNG government to be, you know, like a one-party state or something, but it would like PNG to be stable, because that helps, that affects its interests in the country, where there'd be investment, you know, what have you. So it wants that stability. And the challenge for Australia is, where do we balance between having a stable neighbour or having a democratic neighbour?
No, I think it's where do we balance between being liked and standing up for what we
can. Oh, yeah. Well, that's part of it as well.
That's how I conceptualise it.
Yeah. The question is, yes, Australia's interest shouldn't be about whether they're liked or not, as to whether they can work with somebody like PNG in a complementary manner to China.
Bill, did you want to ask a question? Yes, thank you. A question about
your phrase vassal state is one that intrigues me. I've been looking at 5th and 6th century vassal states in what you call Indochina.
Yeah.
And China has a very expected tribute from those vassal states. What sort of tribute is expected by China from Burma, Laos, Cambodia, for example?
And it wants a good deal, and it wants access to the resources, probably not, you know, at a better price. So it actually wants, and it also wants them to not, you know, to be part of, part of its geopolitical interests, much more than, let's say, in Africa, it wants them to vote for it at the UN and those sorts of things. But the vassal states, I think it wants to be much more closely receive tribute, you know, and have China have probably a greater say in how things happen. And if you get too dependent on any donor, you end up in that situation, because having an opportunity, a different opportunity. It's interesting, somebody did a study on how China and the US dealt with other members of the Security Council, meaning the, was it 12 or whatever it is, who have shorter term appointments. And the US tends to support them, a little bit more aid, that sort of stuff, while China tends to punish them, isn't that fascinating? You know, instead of seeing them as a vote, they saw them as, I think because they have a right of veto, then, so I just, that struck me as a very interesting mindset-y type thing. And, you know, if somebody did the statistics on all these votes and stuff, so I'm presuming they're robust, but it is a very interesting sort of different view.
Last chance for questions.
Patrick, have you got any views on the quality of Chinese aid as compared to, say, Australian aid or US aid or British aid?
They've all had their histories of shoddiness. Australia built a hospital in Fiji when they came to hand over. Fiji said, what? You built it, you run it.
Let's say recently.
Well, that was only 10 years ago. So things changed quite quickly. I notice in Africa, partly because in East Africa, well, I presume in the other African states, partly because I think it's tied to Chinese investment, because China's moving a lot of its production out of China to Africa. The railways they're building there are not shoddy. They're international standards, so the whole thing. And on top of that, I'm not sure who negotiated it, which side of the thing, but in Ethiopia, they have a five-year, build, operate, transfer, right? So that 5 years is to make sure it's not shoddy and fall apart, and to make sure the counterparts can run it. And in Kenya, I think because it goes through much more rugged terrain, rather than just going across the desert, it's actually going through, you know, the mountains and the like. It's a 10-year thing. So part of getting good aid quality is probably how you negotiate things like maintenance, things like how do we keep this going? Because donors, if they can get away with it, they'll get away with it. And so the checks and balances have to be there. And that's part of the discussion. I think Australia can have a role in sort of saying, okay, if you're going to do all these roads in the Pacific, which they're doing, okay, let's have a conversation about, you know, what is the maintenance contract? What warranty are you giving that they won't fall apart next year?
And this is a question related to quality. Is that debt to China? I mean, the PNG has just taken on some big loans and infrastructure, and question the capacity necessarily to take on that level of debt. What happens in 10 years, given the sort of outlays that China doing now? Do you have any predictions on that front?
It's very hard to predict. In 2010, China cancelled all its debt to least developed countries. So, but in the conversation that Stephen and I were involved with others the other day, it was pointed out that in Sri Lanka, they take equity in the asset.
So the response to debt is interesting. I was reading in the paper today, I think it's a paper that PNG is taking another big World Bank loan. You know, so and it's shopping around as well. So what happens to debt is interesting. China doesn't come heavy on debt, though, to the same extent, if you like, the World Bank and others do. Partly because it's very hard to dig it out of the history, but in that sort of polemic, the true story of Mao, they do refer to the debt with the Soviet Union as being a really, really big issue in the late 50s. And so I think part of that story points to flexibility, but Xi Jinping has particular views of the world. And, you know, and he said the other day, or the other month, that he thinks China isn't getting enough for its aid. So, you know, it becomes a leadership thing as to, you know, what does the standing committee, whatever it's called, the Politburo, think about this stuff. But it's a more flexible approach. But I do think people are digging themselves a bit of a hole if they think, oh, no, one day China will... Well, so this is the danger of the vassal state thing, you know. Oh, you had a big debt. Oh, can we be your next best friend, sort of?
All right. Well, we are out of time, I'm afraid. So please come and ask Patrick if you've got any more questions afterwards. But join me there thanking Patrick and Frank.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.